From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last weekend, OTM producer Jamie York and I took a quick trip down to New Orleans because we heard that the floods had washed away much of the old media, and in the process of rebuilding, an extraordinary transformation was underway. When we arrived, the city was holding its much-delayed elections, ending in a runoff to be held next month between the current mayor, Ray Nagin, and Louisiana Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu. There were 23 mayoral candidates, ranging from the serious to the ridiculous.
My favorite of the minor candidates is Manny Chevrolet Bruno, whose campaign slogan is, "A troubled man for troubled times."
David Meeks, city editor of the Times-Picayune, sits on a stoop just outside the French Quarter. His editorial board endorsed Ron Foreman, a favorite of many in the white middle class, not a popular choice in most of the city. But the paper is more popular now than it's ever been, because the Big Easy ain't easy anymore, and neither is its newspaper.
We're scrappy, we're aggressive, we realize the future of the city is at stake, and we wonder, how long will it be before the first Times-Picayune comes off the press without the word Katrina in it? And the answer might be never.
Before the hurricane, David Meeks was the sports editor. You might ask, why would the paper entrust this crisis to a sports editor? Basically because while the staff was evacuating, Meeks saw that the streets were still drivable. He volunteered to ferry reporters around town in one of the paper's delivery trucks, and he convinced his editor, Jim Amos, to let him stay. Then he asked for volunteers. A couple of city desk reporters stepped forward. Also, the pop music critic, the art critic, the religion writer, and editorial writer.
We had a couple other reporters who were in the city. One had been stranded at the Emergency Operations Center. And then a few days later, we had our New Orleans Saints beat writer and one of the sports copy editors come down and join us.
And that was the team that won this year's Pulitzer Prize for breaking news.
You know, it's been the middle of the night, or I wake up and like, what am I doing here? How did I get here?
That's Tremaine Lee, the 27-year-old, now Pulitzer Prize-winning Cub reporter, the one who was stranded when the levees broke. He's in the newsroom as staffers cluster around TVs and computers watching the election returns. Lee moved to the city from Trenton, New Jersey, only 4 months ahead of the storm. But that was plenty of time to feel the rampant skepticism directed at his paper in the precincts he covered.
Very skeptical. They say, oh, we were the Picayune. I mean, mind you, you're in, like, you know, one of the worst neighborhoods, and I'm really trying to talk to you and say, look, you know, I want to make sure it's more than just a name and just another young brother that's just shot dead in the streets. You know, but I remember the time when it was me, Meeks, and Pearlstein were out at the convention center, and they were scrambling for these papers. And they were like, Picayune, you know, they were really coming at. So I realized that it was a lifeline. Now I think they feel that we're on their side, but we'll see what happens once the dust really settles.
You know, look at this. You just can't imagine. It's like something out of The Wizard of Oz where, like, a house falls on a car and it becomes normal down here.
David Lee Simmons, managing editor of the alternative weekly The Gambit, is taking us on a tour of the devastated Ninth Ward. As we pass through streets of wreckage, he marvels at the newfound pugnacity of the Times-Picayune.
One of our former freelancers, one of his first emails, he said, how does it feel to compete with the daily newspaper when the daily newspaper is acting like an alternative news weekly? And I thought it did speak to a kind of re-energizing that was going on at the Times-Picayune after the storm. I mean, I think that the challenge for them is to maintain that level of energy, and it's going to be interesting to see how they do that.
That energy is currently so intense, it's a wonder the city hasn't gone up in a blaze of media, in print, online, and on the airwaves.
We didn't have an hour of news at noon before the hurricane, and we now have 2 hours of morning news on Saturdays and 3 hours of morning news on Sundays, plus the evening newscast that we normally provide.
Mason Granger, president and general manager of WDSU, NBC's affiliate in New Orleans.
And probably most significantly, in the evenings Monday through Friday, we have a half hour of news at 10 o'clock, which is normal, but we also do a local program from 10:30 to 11 every night, Monday through Friday, which is geared specifically to Hurricane Katrina-related information and issues.
To accommodate that added half hour, WDSU actually pushed back the start of The Tonight Show, and they have the advertisers to support it. As to whether they have viewers, who knows? Right now, there are no ratings. Nielsen has packed up its books and left town.
As of the last rating book that we had, which was back in May, we were the second-rated station in the market. I don't know where we stand now, and we won't know until next February. So,
likewise, at WWL, the CBS affiliate that was number one back when there were ratings, innovation is in the air. Now it's added a web-only news show hosted by its broadcast anchors to reach the New Orleans diaspora, which extends from Baton Rouge to Bedminster, New Jersey, and beyond.
You know, the current absence of ratings for both radio and TV means that you don't get a report card the next day on your experiment.
David Walker, Times-Picayune TV critic, says that right now, broadcasting in New Orleans is like a jump ball. For instance, whether news will prevail on radio, as it has for the moment on television, is still up in the air. The winning format may well be music.
Salsa is sort of the sound of the city now because of the roofers and the people working on houses. There was a crew working right out my backyard, and I think it was probably the first time I'd ever heard that beat in my neighborhood.
That beat rocks a shopping strip parking lot in the largely Hispanic suburb of Kenner, courtesy of KGLA-AM Radio Tropical. Ernesto Schweikert owns KGLA, which serves an exploding population of Hondurans, Guatemalans, and since Katrina, Mexicans who are working to rebuild the city. He lived in the station's trailer during the storm, powering his broadcasts with a gasoline-fueled generator with the help from media monoliths like Clear Channel. Sitting in the restaurant he owns nearby, Schweikert's quick to praise his bad weather friends.
They gave me information every day in English, but we were translating. And the community was very happy that we were on the air because they wanted to know where they had food, where there was water, where the Red Cross was.
And Clear Channel was providing that information for free, right?
Yes, all Clear Channel. They even came to give us gasoline.
Clear Channel opened its doors, but city and suburban officials never did.
I was traveling to the different city halls asking for help, avoiding us completely. I mean, I felt so little.
Schweikert says now big corporate advertisers are calling him and that the African-American and Anglo communities can no longer afford to ignore the Hispanics in their midst. He's currently in the process of buying the city's only other Spanish-language station, currently for sale, to keep it Spanish. And he's preparing to build the city's first Spanish-language TV station, which will be digital. In a city where tens of thousands are in the market for new TVs, most of which will be digital-ready, that means instant market penetration.
I can't wait for that, because with the DT, the digital TV, high definition, now on one TV station, you can have three subcarriers. So on one station, like mine will be 42. So if you go to 42, you can watch, let's say, Telemundo. 42.1, Telefutura. 42.2, Univision. 42.3, Central America TV. Yeah, whatever, you know. And I think that now with the TV station, I think even the politicians are going to start having a little bit more respect for us.
You know, we have a scenario now where we can sit there and say, we're like a laboratory for everything new. Because whatever you're doing, I don't want leading edge, I want bleeding edge.
Greg Meffert is the city's chief technology officer, a position created by Nagin. And if the city is a lab, call him Oppenheimer, because he sees his mission as vital to the survival of a city that is fighting a war with nature. So while the state of emergency is still in place, he's defying state law in a rush to make basic wireless internet service as widely available as possible for free.
What we went through with the storm and with the communications breakdown, I can't take that chance again. I just can't. you had all these private telecom providers, and all these networks went down. And at the time when it got really crazy, they said, well, a company can't afford to send somebody in there. I hear snipers are shooting at vendors. I'm not going to go fix the switch. And they didn't. But we were still here.
Meffert says his job will be dissolved if Mayor Nagin doesn't win the runoff. But he doubts that will end the project, even in the political swamp of New Orleans.
You'd have to really just sit there and say, I'm going to have to find a good reason to tell all you thousands of people that are using this right now for your businesses, I got to turn this off because some telecom lobbyist knows my daddy. You know, if you can get away with that, good luck. But I don't see it.
So far, he's got 4 square miles wired. He is shooting for 20.
There's a lot of things that we love that got thrown in that lake. But, you know, there's a lot of things that we didn't love that I think got thrown in there, too. You really do have a situation now where this city is very conscious of that it's fighting for itself and that it's, in the end, even beyond all the Fed this and state that, the only people that really want New Orleans back big is New Orleans.
That's the principal finding to emerge from the media lab that is New Orleans. Access to high-quality information equals survival and damn the bottom line. For Wi-Fi geeks and news managers, that means supplying information by any means necessary. For news consumers, that means taking personal responsibility to stay informed. For reporters, that means looking out for their audiences, even at the risk of losing them. In truth, the Times-Picayune has bored readers for years with headlines about such dry topics as the wetlands.
Long story short, if we had more of these wetlands protecting us, by the time the hurricanes got to the city, they'd be weaker and less dangerous.
Times-Picayune columnist Lolis Eli.
You may not be thinking about that because you're trying to figure out what you're going to do to rebuild your grandmother's house, because that's the last thing she wants in this world. She wants to be back in her house. You're trying to figure that out. You ain't worrying about no wetland loss. You ain't worrying about the ducks that ain't coming no more. You ain't worrying about the tourists. You're worrying about rebuilding that house. Well, part of our job, not unlike that of a physician, is to give you information that you may need, even if you don't understand that you need it.
New Orleanians know all too well that their city is ailing, and they consume barrels of information supplied by a reinvented media like a tonic, even if it's bitter, even if it's about wetlands or racism. The flood made that happen. But it didn't wash across America, not really. This experiment in media and the news consumers who love them seems to end at the water's edge. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week we learned who will be taking over as chief presidential flack, Fox News TV and radio personality Tony Snow. It was clearly a gift from the president to headline writers, Snow Day, Snow Job, etc. But whether it will improve relations with the press is still unknown. Much has been made about the novelty of installing a journalist as spokesman. For 3 decades, press secretaries have tended to come from policy and public relations backgrounds. But there was a time when presidents routinely recruited spokesmen from the other side of the podium. FDR, Eisenhower, JFK, and Ford all did.
Snow, though, is a different animal, very much a product of his times, not just because he's the first TV personality tapped for the job, but because as a Fox News pundit and sometimes substitute for Rush Limbaugh, he straddles the increasingly blurry line between journalism and opinion mongering. Whatever he is, says ABC News political director Mark Halperin, his appointment should be seen as an improvement over the last 5 years of Bush message management.
This White House didn't empower the press secretaries to go out there and drive the message of the day in a way that reporters and the public would find captivating. You often see now the press room half full when Scott McClellan briefs. I think Tony Snow is not going to be afraid or nervous or figuratively sweaty, and maybe even literally sweaty, as Scott McClellan has been at times in the briefing room, because he knows about the mind of the people asking him the questions. He knows how to answer. He knows how to be a performer, because that's what he's been doing for a living on Fox and on radio.
Exactly. He's used to being a performer, and as Rebecca Dana noted in the New York Observer, he's already elicited, because of that performance, a nickname in the White House press corps. They've called him Max Headroom, and she made something of his white, fluffy hair. How much of this do you think is about hair?
38%, maybe 39. I mean, frankly, no offense to Mr. Snow. I don't find him to be that great-looking a guy. He's perfectly attractive. But, you know, they not make Antonio Banderas the White House press secretary. So I think it's more about his performance skills. It's only been two presidencies where the briefing has been televised. I don't think any of the previous television-era press secretaries have used a daily televised briefing to maximum effect. And the thought is that having someone who will use that stage to try to advance the cause of a president, we'll see how effective it can be. And if he's effective, I suspect that the job description for future White House press secretaries will include must have 3 to 5 years of broadcast television or radio experience, because it is an incredibly valuable platform. There's no other press secretary for any entity in the United States whose work commands so much attention, including often live cable and radio coverage, including the ability to become the lead, quote, in the network news and in wire stories all across the world.
He's coming at, everybody says, a terrible time for a White House spokesman. The president's numbers are in the basement. It will take a heck of a salesman to sell policies that have been so discredited.
If conditions with what Americans think of the economy or how things are going in Iraq, which are probably, along with gas prices, the president's three biggest political problems, if those things stay bad, then Tony Snow will not be able to help. On the other hand, I think he will bring a more realistic sense to the White House about what they can say and do while those things evolve in order to get a better hearing from the press corps. And I think that this was about making nice with the Washington press corps, number one, and number two, and probably more important, using the White House podium as an offensive weapon rather than simply using it to get through the briefing because you have to have a briefing because the Washington press corps expects it. That, I think, is the big strength that the White House wants Tony Snow to bring to this, which they did not have in Scott McClellan or Ari Fleischer, both in terms of their abilities, but also in terms of what their brief was, what their charge was. They were not told to go out there and make news. They were told just the opposite.
And Tony Snow says that he's going to have a lot more access to the inner circle than either of those two other people did. Do you think that this White House, which is so suspicious of the press, will actually give their press spokesman access to the inner sanctum?
I think he'll have more access and he'll be more empowered to come into the briefing room to try to make news, to try to shape what the public thinks on issues such as immigration and tax cuts and budget cuts that I think Tony Snow has a chance, at least, to be more effective on than was Scott McClellan.
Right, because we already know his position on things like tax cuts and fiscal responsibility. That's one of the areas in which he has been most vociferously critical of the president. And I wonder, that brings up the problem generally of Snow's paper trail. In fact, the liberal think tank Media Matters posed some questions that it thinks the press corps should ask along the lines of, do you still think President Bush is a wimp who looks impotent for not vetoing any single bill? Or could you elaborate on the, quote, unbearably abstract and dull, unquote, portions of Bush's Social Security sales pitch that, quote, made it stink?
I think this is not going to be his problem. You'll recall that Mike McCurry worked for Senator Bob Kerry when he ran against Bill Clinton for president in 1991 and 1992. Ari Fleischer worked for Elizabeth Dole when she was running for president against George Bush in 1999. And both those gentlemen made statements that were critical of the men they would go on to serve as White House press secretary. So I don't think it's his past statements that are being a big problem. Reporters will ask him once, he'll give some humorous answer, and he'll move on. I think the problem will be if he finds himself disagreeing with the president's policies. He's saying now, well, of course, I'll follow the president's policies. He's in charge. But the question is, if he doesn't agree with the policies, can he take off that pundit hat? Can he wipe away his sensibility, which said, if the president's doing something bad, I'm going to be critical? Because he can't continue to disagree with the president. And he may be underestimating the difficulty he'll have in adjusting the first time the president says, this is what we're doing. And he says, I don't think that's a good idea.
Mark Halperin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Halperin is political director of ABC News. Last Sunday, Arab television broadcast new audio, purportedly of Osama bin Laden, issuing what one counterterrorism expert called a State of the Jihad address, in which he called on his supporters to prepare for a, quote, long war against the Crusader plunderers in Western Sudan. But lately, he's not the only one who talks about digging in.
When we talk about the long war, we're talking about...
This is going to be a long war, and I think we need to look at it as a long war.
One of the principles that we follow in the long war...
How do we learn if we're going to fight a long war, and we are, if we're facing...
We need to look at the war as a long war and understand...
It's now calling it the long war.
Last February, coinciding with the release of the Pentagon's Quadrennial Defense Review, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld delivered a speech titled The Long War, in which he conjured up imagery of the Cold War, while laying out broad strategies to fight what could be a decades-long terrorist threat across the globe. Gideon Rose is the managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. He says that the administration's attempt to brand this war mid-conflict won't ensure that it'll be remembered that way.
Nobody woke up in the 14th century in England and said, gee, I'm going off to fight this part of the Hundred Years' War. I think part of the problem here is you've pegged it just right. They're thinking of this as a brand, whereas properly understanding the conflict that you're involved in is the key towards developing a sensible and viable strategy for waging the conflict.
First and most enduringly, it seems, this conflict was called the Global War on Terror, or as experts call it, GWAT. That seems to have been the stickiest moniker, but why has the administration backed away from it?
Well, one of the chief problems here is that the administration was trying to conflate three separate issues, which is the struggle against al-Qaeda and other kinds of radical Islamist terrorism on the one hand, country-specific security issues such as that posed by Saddam Hussein or Iran's attempt to gain nuclear weapons and so forth on the other hand, and then finally political development in the Middle East more generally. The administration tried to make an argument that all these things were related, and the administration has had trouble both selling what it was doing at all and lumping all its various efforts together in one simple, easy-to-understand package.
But if that was the problem with the Global War on Terror, they didn't really take great strides to solve it with its next phrase, which was a little more cumbersome, called the Global Struggle Against Violent Extremism, or GSAVE. It seems though all the problems were inherent in that phrase as well.
Yeah, that one seemed to be an attempt to get beyond this question of why some terrorists but not other terrorists were the target. You were not going to go to war against the Tamil Tigers. You were not going to take the IRA all that seriously. The substantive issue was violent extremists who were using terrorism as a tactic. So let's talk about violent extremism as the problem rather than terrorism. It was an attempt to move in the right direction substantively, but it was indeed both cumbersome, and GSAVE really didn't lend itself to anything interesting or catchy in the first place.
So, Gideon, now we have the long war. What's the idea here? Is it supposed to resonate like the good war, which is the phrase attached to World War II, or the Cold War, or both?
Well, I think the phrase the Cold War wasn't a brand so much as a description. It was a reference to a long-term geopolitical conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union that was kept cold by nuclear weapons and didn't actually result in a military battle like the subsets like Korea and Vietnam. But it was a useful concept because it never let you forget that fundamentally the United States and the Soviet Union were engaged in a long-term war of positions for control, not just of geographic territory, but also the loyalties and minds of people in their own spheres and the world at large. And so the chief virtues of the long war concept are, first, that it stresses that don't worry about the short-term problems because this is a very long struggle which we're in the early stages of. So it seems to put in perspective by its very terminology the problems we've encountered so far. And second of all, it carefully eliminates the question of long war against what. And so it kind of sidesteps the whole question of who the chief target is and how other peripheral conflicts are related to the chief target by not talking about them whatsoever.
Now, the long war is using the word war, at least in part metaphorically, since this struggle is supposed to be waged as much through diplomacy as arms. But how about the word long? I mean, that doesn't seem one likely to resonate with a public that, at least according to the polls, isn't much interested in keeping troops in Iraq for very long.
Well, I think that long war isn't going to make it a catchy, saleable thing. What they're really hoping is it gets them out of the dilemma of having lost the war. If you say long war, then it hasn't been lost because by definition, we're only in the early stages of it. It's very ambiguity, and its implication that you shouldn't get hung up on current problems is its chief virtue for them. If you actually were to give it more detail, it would be legitimate. There is going to be a very long struggle against radical Islamist terrorism. The problem is the administration has gotten stuck because they want to package and sell all their various efforts together, and they want to do so when they're not going particularly well.
So it's your assessment then that this just isn't going to work?
I guess what I'd say is the following. The Bush administration has engaged in far worse crimes against language than the long war. Calling preventive war a policy of preemption was a very, very bad thing because they perverted the use of language and deliberately obscured the radical nature of what they were trying to achieve. Calling this the long war is both vague and somewhat accurate. It doesn't involve the kind of political machinations and deliberate verbal trickery with an intent to deceive that the concept of preemption, as the administration defined it, did. And so I would go easy on the people who came up with the long war and think of them as overburdened flacks trying hard to package a bad product rather than deliberately evil spinmeisters trying to pull a fast one on the rest of us.
All right. Gideon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Gideon Rose is managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. For years now, government agencies have been quietly reviewing declassified documents and removing them from public shelves, sometimes because they could compromise national security, sometimes, it appears, for no good reason at all. A 1995 executive order by President Clinton, amended by President Bush in 2003, did give the green light to the CIA and other agencies to remove some documents, even after the customary 25-year limit on classification expired. But that order allowed for reclassification only under certain circumstances and with certain restrictions. Historians cried foul when the current seemingly covert operation to effectively undeclassify documents was exposed. They complained to the Information Security Oversight Office in February. Director J. William Leonard agreed to conduct an audit to find out what was going on. The results are now in. Bill Leonard, what did you find?
We found that since the current executive order had been implemented back in 1995, 25,315 records had been withdrawn from public access at the archives, purportedly because they contained classified national security information.
You sampled about 1,300 of them, and through that you determined that about two-thirds of them did contain information that should remain classified.
They contained information that met the standards for continued classification. I think an important point to recognize is that the current framework, it talks in terms of information that can be classified. It doesn't necessarily talk about what should be classified. Part of the decision process is the exercise of discretion and of judgment. But at the very least, two-thirds of the information did satisfy the standards for continued classification.
About a third of the documents, a little more than a third, may not have been properly undeclassified. What were the most common mistakes you found in your sample?
There was a disturbingly large number of documents that, for the most part, were unclassified in their substance and solely were being restricted because on the CC line they had the name of a CIA official. Now, sometimes, of course, that can be very sensitive, but we found many times this CIA official was well known to work at the CIA and that the CIA themselves had disclosed previously.
Do you think this was mostly a question of overzealous classifiers?
It's a reflection, I believe, of the culture. We rightfully identify and take action against individuals who disclose classified information in an unauthorized manner. What we fail to do, sometimes at all, is to take action against individuals who improperly restrict information in the first place. Every cleared individual, all 3 million of those Americans with security clearances, they have an affirmative responsibility to challenge what they perceive to be inappropriate classification decisions. It's never done, or very rarely done, but yet in the framework, in the executive order, it makes it very clear that there is that expectation.
What do you propose there?
I'm asking agency heads to reinforce that affirmative obligation we all have. I'm asking them to appoint full-time officials whose sole role will be to facilitate and to encourage these classification challenges. I'm asking agency heads to conduct their own audits of their classified products, but don't wait 40 or 50 years to do it. You know, in the month of June, audit and sample what you did in May and make sure that when people classified it, it was in fact in accordance with the standards. Track the results of that, provide feedback, look at your trends, and adjust your training accordingly.
But as you say, you're pulling against a culture of secrecy.
One of the things I mentioned the other day, it's an analogy that I feel very strongly about. To state the obvious, we're a nation at war. We send our young men and women into combat every day. We ask them to engage the enemy as part of their duty. We expect that they will wield their weapons with discipline and they will not do it indiscriminately. And they recognize that if they do, they will individually be held accountable. What I'm advocating is it's about time that us bureaucrats here are similarly held accountable with respect to how we wield the national security tools at our disposal. Now, there's a big difference between an M4 rifle and a classification stamp. I recognize that. But at the same time, if we wield that critical national security tool indiscriminately, we will undermine its integrity. And if we undermine its integrity, it will not be able to protect the truly sensitive information that everyone recognizes we need to restrict access to in order to help preserve this nation's security.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
J. William Leonard is the director of the Information Security Oversight Office. We'll link to the audit from our site, or you can find it at archives.gov. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Italians breathed a sigh of relief when their Supreme Court saved them from a Florida 2000 recount scenario. Outgoing center-right Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi lost out to Romano Prodi's center-left coalition by a mere 25,000 votes. He's barely a week in the job, but Prodi already is under pressure to rewrite the media ownership laws that allowed Berlusconi to build his Mediaset empire. For now, the new prime minister says he'll focus on the stagnant economy. But the media holdings of Mr. Berlusconi have long been a sore point for many in Italy. He owns most of the private channels in the country. As leader, he also controlled the state-owned channels. And during his tenure, he didn't hesitate to fire any journalist, commentator, or even satirist not to his taste. The banning of political satire from TV has a long history in Italy. From Rome, Megan Williams reports on where it still thrives and where it's going.
It's Thursday night at a high school near the central train station in Rome. Several hundred people of all ages crowd into a dark converted garage. Exposed wiring and pipes line the walls. For many people here, it's standing room only. They've come to see this week's documentary. Gustavo Hofer is one of the founders of Apollo Undici, this garage-cum-cultural center. Hofer explains that because Italian TV no longer shows political documentaries, he and some others decided to offer Romans a place to come and see them.
Basically, what we see on television is an Italy which doesn't exist, and we, with our little cinema here, are trying to tell the reality of Italy.
Tonight's film is Forza Italia, a satirical documentary about political corruption and state control in the 1970s. It's one of the few times the film has been shown in Italy. For 28 years, it was virtually banned, and its director, Roberto Faenza, was blackballed from making movies here. Faenza sits in a cramped office tucked behind the converted garage where his movie's showing.
In Italy, we have a culture that allowed the political parties to control the most important channel of information, that is the state television.
Until 2 decades ago, there were only 3 TV channels, all state-run. Then Silvio Berlusconi, before he became prime minister, opened 3 private stations. With Berlusconi in control, censorship only got worse, and the biggest target has been political satirists. Those willing to stand up to the leader have been kicked off the airwaves. But as Faenza points out, a few have kept their satire going, albeit in different formats.
Such as going in the theater, because you don't reach masses, the audience of television. So they leave you survive there.
Comedian Sabina Guzzanti is one example. Her satirical show on state Rai TV was canceled after the first episode, despite its popularity. The Italian government said her parodies of politicians weren't satire, but bad taste. Guzzanti wasn't deterred, though. She took the second episode live to a theater in Rome. 15,000 people showed up to see her parody of Prime Minister Berlusconi.
Ineligibile, perché per legge io ci penso.
Then Guzzanti made a documentary about being censored, which has sold thousands of DVDs.
Tutto il teatro, per esempio, che conta, da Shakespeare.
All the important theater, from Shakespeare on, is full of political situations.
Playwright and Nobel laureate Dario Fo was one of the first to be banned by Italian TV in the 70s, when his TV skits proved too uncomfortable for the Christian Democratic Party in power.
And when I was stopped from doing satire, people would say, sure, go ahead and be an artist, be an actor, but leave politics alone. Just make us laugh.
It's the same message today. Political commentator Enzo Biaggi, for instance, had his decade-long show canceled after Oscar winner Roberto Benigni lampooned Berlusconi during a guest appearance.
Io non dicevo che se ne dovessero andare, dicevano che dovevano essere onesti.
On Rai TV, Berlusconi defended the banning of Biaggi and other satirists.
Dissi allora che avevano fatto un uso.
I never attacked people like Enzo Biaggi, said Berlusconi. I attacked their behavior because they'd been criminal in their use of television. Roberto Benigni is one of the only satirists who's been able to go after politicians like Berlusconi during guest TV performances. He told a group of reporters it's too tempting to pass up and also good for the country.
Satire is the health of society. It's democracy that whips itself. It's either against power or else it's not satire. There are some people who attract satire. And Berlusconi, I have to say, even if he didn't have power, would attract satire. Even when he was in the opposition, I used to say, let's hope he gets elected. It would be a gift from the gods.
But director Roberto Faenza says that making fun of corrupt or power-hungry politicians isn't enough. That real democracy comes when a nation accepts satire being turned on themselves as well.
Until that Mussolini was alive, 99% of Italians were with Mussolini. Once that Mussolini fell down, nobody was a fascist anymore. The day after, they were all Democrats. So Berlusconi is only the tip of the iceberg, but behind Berlusconi there are masses of Italians who should be heavily criticized. Until we do this, we will never understand what's bad and what's good.
L'anomalia in Italia sono i comunisti e il loro odio verso di me.
As Italians get more exposed to Italy's alternative voices through satire in theaters, movies, or DVDs, their appetite is growing. Nanni Moretti's just released film Il Caimano, The Alligator, is a gripping political satire about Berlusconi. But not just. It's also a biting condemnation of Italians' passivity in the face of state control, manipulation, and corruption. The fact that it's been a runaway hit is a sign that Italians may now be willing to look critically at their leaders and themselves. And Italians will know soon enough whether the new leadership sees things the same way.
E allora andiamo a cominciare!
For On the Media, I'm Megan Williams in Rome.
We end this hour where we began, in New Orleans. For those of us who don't live there, the city was briefly a national stage for a number of prominent journalists who tapped a vein of frustration and rage. But for the New Orleanians themselves, there have been few natives giving voice to their anger and their acute need for answers. The man who has probably filled that role best is Garland Robinette.
Kathleen Blanco on a busy, busy day with the president and doing all the things you're doing here in New Orleans today, giving us a couple of minutes to talk to us. Appreciate it very much. How do I phrase this in a professional way? The hell is going on with the House Appropriations Committee?
Well, I just...
Robinette has a deep-rooted relationship with the Big Easy. He and his now former wife anchored the local CBS Evening News for years. But long since retired and happily painting portraits, Robinette was just filling in for a sick friend, radio talk show host David Tyree, when he temporarily took to the air on a local AM station. It might have been just a little noticed favor, had the station not had a particularly powerful signal, and had Robinette not agreed to come in to work on August 29th, 2005.
The radio station called and said, look, we're kind of short person. Can you come in just for tonight? Very reluctant. I said, yes. Katrina comes in. The building is literally, with no exaggeration, blown apart. When the water came, we ran down to the cars, got in the cars, drove out through 3 feet of water, just nightmare scenario, people swimming in the water, trying to get to us, got out, made our way to Baton Rouge, where we broadcast in a closet. And during that period, David Tyree died.
Now, you are recording, as you say, from a closet. And when you're recording from a closet in another city, it's like sending a message in a bottle. So what was the reaction when you found out that you were broadcasting across at least 12 states to the whole New Orleanian diaspora and the rest of the country, that you were being streamed live on the internet?
When they told me, shortly after the storm, that we were streaming on the internet. I didn't know if somebody was peeing on a computer. I didn't know what that meant. And it just went on. I said, great, that's terrific. Got a caller second or third night after Katrina, when I was kind of going nuts and saying, America, where are you? Got a call from Australia. And I thought it was a friend of mine making a joke. And somewhere in the interview, I realized I'm talking to Australia. And then shortly after, it was France. And then shortly after, it was Japan. And all of a sudden, I knew that we have accidentally just landed in the midst of something just never happened before in New Orleans.
Now, we know that in the wake of Katrina, several news people really raised their profiles. Anderson Cooper on CNN, Shepard Smith on Fox. But the voice of New Orleans seems to have been yours. That's not, strictly speaking, a journalistic role, is it? And after 20 years as one of the local co-anchors on the local TV news, was it a strange position to be in, or did it feel natural?
It's truly not being modest. It's being analytical. It really hasn't been me. This station ended up being who the people listened to when there was no other communications. And being in the midst of it has been terrifying, because TV news, quite frankly, I got bored of it very quickly. I wasn't a very good journalist. I wasn't a serious journalist. And reading into a prompter and knowing that it was primarily blue hair in a lot of it, and the look of Ken and Barbie for TV.
You and your wife co-anchored local news on your station here for a while. You say that she was generally regarded as the more serious journalist.
Oh, absolutely. She, to this day. I was the environmental guy, and back in the 70s and 80s, to be an environmental reporter was to be environmental wacko, and not where I wanted to be, and that's why I quit. When I go on the air today, I will have spent 3 hours from 5 o'clock this morning prepping, and when I go on, I'm fully aware that there are no notes, and there are no scripts, and maybe 8 million people listening. That's pretty amazing.
All humility aside then, you do know, you are credited with expressing the anger of your community. So here we are talking on Monday. What are you angry about today, Garland?
Well, it's the election, and I kind of can't wait to get on the air for the battle, because I know everybody in the listening audience is going to disagree with me. Everything I've read so far was strong voter turnout. New York Times, New Orleans heading for a change. What I read was 38% of the registered voters showed up. I'm embarrassed. I'm horrified. I cannot believe it. We are in a fight for our financial and possibly physical lives here. 38% of the people show up. I can't wait to get on the air to say, what the hell am I missing here?
What was the event on your air that got people most upset?
That's like choosing from herd of buffalo. There were a lot of them. I think the one that have gotten them most upset with me is the infamous Nagin interview of the storm.
The interview with the mayor, Ray Nagin.
Yes, Mayor Nagin.
This is ridiculous. And I don't want to see anybody do any more goddamn press conferences. Put a moratorium on press conferences. We don't do another press conference until the resources are in this city, and then come down to this city and stand with us when there are military trucks and troops that we can't even count. Don't tell me 40,000 people are coming here. They're not here. It's too doggone late. Now get off your asses and let's do something, and let's fix the biggest goddamn crisis in the history of this country.
He's walking the water with bodies floating past him. He was offered babies by mothers on overpasses that were afraid they were going to die. Where he was at the Hyatt Hotel was interconnected with the building where our radio station is. Imagine a huge hotel. If you dropped a bomb on it, well, he was there. He went through unbelievable trauma. He went through war. And when he hit the air with me, you know, none of us had planned that. I didn't know he was going to call. I don't think he really knew he was going to call. Just probably a PR agent gave him a phone, said, you ought to call them. They got a big audience. And he ended up angry and cursing. And after it was over, he got considerable criticism for it. And to this day, I say, you know, you people are just full of it. The man initiated the recovery. There is no doubt in my mind. If he hadn't done that, that recovery might have been 2 days later.
How do you know that his anger helped quicken the federal response?
Because the President of the United States showed up the next afternoon, and he had named him, and he had cursed, and he had railed, just absolutely told it just the way it was, and the President showed up. The President did not show up because it was the time to show up. He was late. He was very, very late. And for the people that hear me saying, oh, here we go, a liberal reporter on NPR, I'm a conservative. You know, he showed up late. And if the mayor hadn't said that, I don't know when he would have showed up. And not just the president, the congressional representatives, the military, and on and on and on.
Do you think that what you're doing is, strictly speaking, journalism?
No, I don't. Journalism is, to me, not as terrifying, but it's a whole lot better. People may not always agree with the journalists, but they're thinking about it. You know, they're covering it. They're doing their research. Times-Picayune, if it hadn't been here, we'd have been screwed. We'd have never known any of the stuff we know today that's helped us. But what I do is spontaneous. It's off the top of the head, and there are innumerable times on a daily basis I say things and go, what the hell were you talking about? That's stupid. You know, a lady called me the other day, and we were grousing about the Army Corps of Engineers, and she said, what part of the government are they with? And I said, I think Homeland Security. It's the Army Corps of Engineers. Well, when you're a journalist, pretty good chance you're not going to make a dumb mistake like that. So I think what I do has some benefit because people that talk to me don't get edited, but journalism is a whole lot more important.
So what do you think your role is in this chapter of New Orleans history?
I didn't figure that out myself. You know, the Times-Picayune did a nice story, and they called me the voice of New Orleans, and I was just beyond flattered. You know, but I thought about it later on, and the hospital people that went through nightmares. I mean, if you knew what the hospital industry did here, you wouldn't believe it. It sounds like a bad B-grade movie. People out of ICU on the floors, and they're using hand pumps to keep them alive. People shooting at them. People trying to break in to get drugs. Water coming up, and on and on and on. Policemen that went through the same thing. Firemen that went through the same thing. And I think to myself, you know, I'm flattered. I really am. But again, I go back to the true voices here are just never going to be heard. They're just never going to be heard.
Garland, thank you very much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Garland Robinette hosts his think tank on WWL AM Talk Radio in New Orleans. We spoke to him in his living room. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Bolo, and edited by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson our engineer, this week with help from Rob Christensen. We also had help from Ani Katz and Mark Phillips. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Catcher Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.